to Insight. Joining me tonight is not Allie. Surprise, you're stuck with me tonight, but I have two very special guests to help me out with this episode. I'm going to let the two Mikes introduce themselves and tell us about their shows.
Hello, everyone. This is Mike Ferguson. I also go by Fergie.
It's Mike Gibson. Go by Gibby.
More so than I go by Fergie, but we host True Crime All the Time, and then we have a sister podcast called True Crime All the Time Unsolved. I'm pretty sure you can figure out the difference between the two. If you haven't listened, please give it a chance. Download and see what you think.
All right. We really appreciate you guys coming on the show. Even though Allie isn't recording tonight, she is the one who researched and wrote the script, and she will be doing the editing. The three of us were just showing up to look pretty tonight. So thank you to Allie for all of the pre- and post-production work. Tonight's case is the story of Samantha Knight. On an August day in 1986, 9-year-old Samantha Knight left her house presumably to buy some candy and seemingly disappeared into thin air. Despite one of the largest searches in New South Wales history and numerous persons of interest, Samantha's disappearance remained unsolved for 16 years. That was until 1996, when a man named Anthony Michael Guider came to the police's attention for 60 separate child abuse offenses. More surprisingly, this was a man they had previously questioned in relation to Samantha's disappearance. And it turned out he was a man who actually knew Samantha and her mother. So let's start at the beginning with Samantha's early life. In 1976, Tess Knight and Peter O'Meager were married. Tess got pregnant almost immediately, and their daughter Samantha was born on March 25th of the following year. They got a little place in a Sydney suburb of Manly and set up their family life. In part due to their age and in part due to the huge life changes, the marriage was strained and the couple split fairly early on. Getting married and having a kid within a year at a young age is actually something I've done. It's pretty hard. So I can see how a family would split up with this kind of pressure. When Tess and Peter separated, Tess moved Samantha to Bronte, where they lived for the next couple of years. In 1981, Tess became romantically involved with Tony Thexton, which resulted in Tess and Samantha moving closer to where Tony lived, which was back in Manly. And that following year is when Samantha started school, and she loved it. She made friends very easily, and she became close to two little girls who also lived in Manly, Anissa and Amy. There were regular sleepovers and playdates, mostly at Amy's house. So obviously, Tess and Amy's mother, Lisa, became close friends too. Soon after this, in 1983, Tess and Tony split. Tess became increasingly depressed and moved her and Samantha back to Bronte. Now, these two places are around 40 to 45 minutes apart, but when you're a little girl separated from your best friends, that's a very, very far distance. So Tess regularly made the trip with Samantha back to Manly so she could see her friends and have sleepovers at Amy's house. At the time of her disappearance in 1986, 9-year-old Samantha Knight was like any other 9-year-old girl. She loved her mom, her cat. She had a favorite toy she slept with that had the place of honor on her bed, her Raggedy Ann doll. She collected stickers and rocks. She was learning to play the guitar. She loved nothing more than dressing up, playing board games with her friends. She was described as having an infectious smile, and everyone thought she was clever, friendly, and beautiful.
So on August 19th, 1986, Tess Knight was leaving her class at the local art institute a little later than usual. She got caught up after class and missed her bus. She wasn't worried, though. Samantha often arrived home before her and waited at home for her mom. She got changed out of her school clothes, had an after-school snack, and did her homework. And if she got lonely after that, she would just go visit one of the neighbors at the Bondi apartment complex that they lived at. Tess usually got home at 5 p.m., but because she missed the bus, she arrives home an hour later at 6 p.m. As soon as Tess walks through the door, it is a hive of activity. and Samantha telling her about her day. On this day, though, it is unusually quiet, except for the television running at a pretty low volume in the background. And a half-eaten snack is on the kitchen bench, which showed that she did come home after school. However, there was no sign of her daughter now. At first, Tess wasn't concerned that Samantha wasn't there. There had been occasions when Tess was late that Samantha would just go to the neighbor's home for company. But a visit to the neighbors revealed that they hadn't seen her that afternoon either. And phone calls to Samantha's friends' homes didn't help. So this is when all the panic finally set in. Tess tried to think through the situation as logical as possible. She calls Samantha's father, Peter, and also her former partner, Tony. Even though Tess and Tony have been split up for about 3 years at this point, Samantha was still close with him. She didn't think that Samantha would travel that far without her, but she calls them anyway. Neither one of them heard from her. With no other places to search for her daughter, about 7 p.m., Tess calls the police, and that kickstarted one of the biggest searches in New South Wales history.
The following day, the police start their search for Samantha. They talk to the neighbors, but that didn't give police any more clues than it did to Tess the night before. By lunchtime, Operation Samantha is launched with helicopters, dog squads, about 50 uniformed police, and thousands of volunteers who had turned up to help look for Samantha. And hundreds of missing person posters were shipped all around the country. Pictures were plastered on power poles, shop windows, anywhere you can think of all across the country. The media reported on her disappearance on the front page, and there were hourly news updates on television. This led to witnesses quickly coming forward who saw Samantha walking the streets of Bondi in a pair of open-toed blue sandals, her blue school pullover, and an oversized pink tube skirt. And this was a skirt that Samantha hadn't quite grown into yet, but she liked to wear it anyway for dress-ups because she loved to look more grown up. And there was a shopkeeper that reported she came into his shop looking for her lost keys. She was there earlier in the afternoon, about 4:30 p.m. She bought some candy and a pencil. And then she returned later to see if she had left her keys. Another witness said she saw Samantha about 300 meters from her home around 5:30 p.m. So that was about 2 hours after she would have gotten home from school. Samantha told this witness that she had lost her key and was waiting for her mother to come home. And this led the police to the theory that Samantha may have left home to buy something from the shops, then lost her keys, and that's when she was abducted. Where this theory came from was all based off the fact that there was nothing to suggest forced entry into the apartment or that Samantha was motivated to run off. I mean, she loved school. She had close friends, a good relationship with her mother, and she didn't take any personal items. They also spoke to Samantha's father and stepfather, and both of them were immediately cleared of being involved in some type of custody stunt. The police's theory was further supported by a local pharmacist who claimed she had come into his pharmacy to buy a toothbrush.
We're just going to take a quick break for a word from a sponsor before we go further into the investigation to where Samantha was. Okay, this might sound kind of ridiculous, but I made a Blue Apron meal this week, and it is literally the only thing I can think about. It was a black bean and cheese torta, and I have to say, the ingredients were incredibly fresh and delicious. The recipe was fantastic. Clear pictures, easy to follow. Their website even has cooking tips if you don't know what these different words mean, if you don't know what these different pans are for. All sorts of information. That's fantastic. Blue Apron sets high standards for these ingredients, and they're building a community of home chefs, and I am one of them. One of the things I loved about this recipe and all the recipes I get from Blue Apron is that they shipped me the exact amount of each ingredient required for the recipe. It reduced food waste. It reduced my thinking. I just had to chop what was in front of me. And now there are some upcoming meals that I am looking forward to. They have a crispy wild Alaskan pollock and garlic mashed potatoes with roasted broccoli and tartar sauce, and seared steak and garlic butter with oven fries and romaine salad. There's no commitment, so I only get the deliveries when I want them. You can check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first order with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/site. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/site. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Police dressed up a mannequin in the clothes Samantha was wearing in an effort to jog people's memories who had been in the area where she went missing that afternoon. And we saw this done in another case we covered, the Princess Doe case, and that is back in episode 30. This mannequin in the clothes did generate a number of calls from people claiming, yes, they had seen Samantha. And the police chased down every single one of those reports. They checked them. They double-checked them. Many were false, like the report of Samantha being seen at a Bronte supermarket. And ultimately, none of them led to the police to what happened to her or where she was. At this point, two homicide detectives were called in to assist. There was an ill feeling from very early on in the investigation that Samantha would not be found alive. Because of her age and because of the way she was dressed, they believed she was lured by a stranger off the street and either voluntarily or involuntarily got into a car. They determined there would have to be a car involved because abduction by foot would have been too high risk at being seen by more witnesses. They profiled that Samantha would not have known her abductor, that he had chosen her at random. They believe that this was not his first crime, that he had committed crimes similar in the past because of the way he managed to abduct Samantha without an obvious struggle. He knew how to cover his tracks and how not to arouse suspicion. They believed he was most likely known to the criminal legal system. As it turns out, even though police will end up being right with most of this profile, they were horribly wrong on the most identifying point. The killer was a person Samantha and Tess knew. He was someone Samantha had come to trust in the years prior to her disappearance. But this was a time before electronic databases, so police had no effective way of matching their psychological profile to a name, or even making a thorough list of persons of interest to look into. There was only one way to do this work, and that was to hit the streets and talk to as many known child offenders that they knew of in the area Samantha went missing.
The first to be interviewed was a man known to the police only as Werewolf, due to the face covered with abundance of facial hair. He was a convicted child molester and only lived down the street from where Samantha lived. He claimed to be at home during the time period police believed the abduction happened, watching some cooking shows on TV. It wasn't the most solid of alibis, but it was verified by the police, and the police were able to clear him from suspicion. Next, a man by the name of Goodwin was brought to the attention of the police. He apparently had approached a 14-year-old girl the night Samantha went missing. He got her to come home with him, and he sexually assaulted her. However, when the police looked further into this, it ended up being only partially right. Yes, there was a 14-year-old girl, but she was a guest staying with him and his wife, not a stranger. It didn't fit the MO they were looking for. He, too, was cleared for suspicion. And then on August 29th, police got a tip of another person of interest. It was a man who also did not live far from Tess and Samantha, and he had recently returned from the Philippines, where he had taken part in a sex tour involving girls aged between 9 and 11. It wasn't something they could prove, and further digging into his whereabouts when Samantha went missing also led to a dead end. On September 4th, police spoke to a man named Cuff. He had a number of convictions, including one for aggravated assault on a 12-year-old girl, and he was known to visit the Bondi area at least twice a week for most of that year. During the police interview, he admitted to being sexually interested in girls as young as seven. Seven. Shocking. Wow. He said he couldn't remember where he was on the day Samantha went missing. When asked what he thought happened to her, he gave police a theory that she was abducted and sexually abused, that she might still be alive and still be abused, or she might have been killed and dumped. He said he might do something like that himself, but then again, he probably wouldn't. He was referred to a psychiatrist to see if he was capable of actually attacking a young female given the chance. It was the view of the psychiatrist, however, that despite his prior convictions, there was the belief that he didn't have the nerve to follow through on his fantasies.
A little over a week later, on September 15th, another man came to the investigators' attention. A man was arrested at Bondi Beach for following and harassing two young girls, and they were young. We're talking about ages 4 and 8. And you said it, Gibbs, shocking.
It shocks me, man.
Those numbers, I mean, I don't know what other word you would say, Charlie. I mean, that type of stuff to us is shocking.
Unfortunately, we cover cases where we hear this so often, but it's appalling. And whenever we look into these cases and we start reading about all of the people they've interviewed who fit this profile of being interested in young girls, it gets even more shocking.
It's just so disturbing.
And during questioning, this man claimed that he was an employee of the Australian-Israeli consulate, which he was not. Like Cuff, he couldn't remember where he was on the day Samantha went missing, and police thought they were really onto something with this guy. Until they got a phone call from a local psychiatric unit saying he had been a patient there until late in August, so he could not have been involved in the abduction. And then 5 days later, an informant contacted police about a man named Atkins. He was drinking with the informant at Bondi Pub when the subject of Samantha's disappearance came up. He chimed in with the quote, "Killing's not hard. Anyone can do it if they really want to," unquote. The informant was adamant that Atkins wasn't someone to say something unless it was really true. But again, a little digging, and he had also been a psychiatric patient during the time that Samantha went missing. And finally, the police received a call they were hoping never to get, but one that could give them the answers that they were looking for. A woman identifying herself only as Trish said she was a psychiatric nurse and one of her patients, a 32-year-old, had confessed to Samantha's murder earlier that week, but had since been transferred to Queensland. She said she would not give her real name and details because she was afraid for her safety if she did so. She said that this patient told her Samantha could be found at Wentworth Falls in the Blue Mountains. So the next day, 70 police were dispatched, and they spent more than 6 hours desperately searching a 5-kilometer or about a 3-mile radius of bush. But they found nothing.
For their part, the Knights did a lot of work to investigate and to keep Samantha in the public's eye. They got church groups to pass out more than 400 posters around Bondi within days of her disappearance. Tess's dad, Bill, gave full-length interviews with newspapers and news outlets asking for more volunteers to help look for his granddaughter and it worked. 100 more adults, as well as groups of children from the local schools, turned out to help in the search for Samantha on the weekend following her disappearance. They covered a lot of ground. They searched coastlines and garbage dumps and parks and back lanes. Again, they didn't find anything. This also led to more calls coming through to the police, but again, they didn't lead to anything. One mentioned a possible sighting of Samantha on the other side of Sydney between 3 and 4 on the afternoon she went missing. This would have been impossible considering school didn't let out until 3, and she wasn't well experienced in taking public transportation locally, let alone crossing a large city like Sydney. So even if it was possible for her to get there in time, it was unlikely she would have done so on her own. Another promising call mentioned a plot of freshly dug up soil behind an abandoned apartment block. But again, this amounted to nothing. Like many high-profile cases, there were disgusting pranks too. A father called police to report a sighting 4 days after Samantha went missing. He claimed his 10-year-old son had seen Samantha at 7 p.m. 24 hours later, same man called back and admitted he had made the whole thing up. Then there was a man who contacted police several times, saying he was holding Samantha at gunpoint. Thankfully for call tracking, he was still on what would be the last of these calls when an armed tactical response team showed up at his house at 2:30 in the morning and hauled him away. And finally, another simply lovely person went to the lengths of putting his daughter on the phone and having her tell police, "He's got me, he's got me." And just a word of warning to anyone considering doing any of these idiotic things, you will get caught. Call tracking is a thing. And there are heavy fines and even jail sentences if you do this. And so that's our PSA for this episode out of the way. With no solid leads, no suspects, and no evidence of what happened to Samantha, even just a week into the investigation, fresh information slowed considerably. And any information that did come in wasn't useful. There was a report of a well-dressed man that was apparently standing with a girl that matched Samantha's appearance as she was waiting to cross a street near her apartment, only about an hour before the last sighting of her. Police did track this down. They spoke to the man and they cleared him. It was simply a case of same place, same time, and nothing more. Or so it seemed at the time. It would be 16 years before the horrible facts of what happened the day of Samantha's disappearance would be revealed. We're going to take one more break from a word from our sponsor.
Buying great sheets is an easy way to upgrade your nightly routine. The right sheets can literally make or break a good night's sleep and help you feel better and well-rested every day. I know that being a mum to 3 crazy kids and working on getting insight out to you every week, I need a good night's sleep. And my Brooklinen sheets are an essential part of this. They are quality sheets made for a quality sleep. And not only are they well made and comfortable, they look good too. They have versatile colours and patterns that you can mix and match to complement any decor. I have the solid navy sheets with matching pillowcases paired with the navy dot duvet cover. And they look amazing. This is luxury bedding under price. You have to try these sheets today. I love my Brooklinen sheets. Try these sheets, and I know you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try for yourself or as a gift this holiday season. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code SITE. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever.
The well-dressed man was Michael Anthony Guider, It would be many years before he would come to the police's attention in connection with Samantha. Guider was born in South Melbourne on October 20th, 1950. He lived in a hostel for single mothers for most of his childhood with his mother and his younger brother, Tim. His mother had schizophrenia and a gambling addiction, which ultimately resulted in the brothers spending some time in state care. This eventually became a permanent arrangement when Guider was 11 years old. Tim also had some health issues, and Guider resented all the extra attention he got for it. So much so, and a somewhat disturbing look into what's to come. He would manufacture incidents that put Tim in danger. An example of this was one occasion Tim was in his pram. The brake somehow became unhinged, and Tim went into the surf. Another time, a washing machine toppled onto Tim while it was just him and Guider in the room. He left the child's home at age 17 and went between boarding houses and between menial jobs. He eventually convinced a family in Bondi to let him move in with them. It was during this time he realized he was quite good at winning people over by presenting himself as a charming and helpful person. He managed to live with his family for several years without any issue. And then in 1975, Guider had a two-year affair with a married woman. This obviously ended in tears. Desperate to win her back, Guider steals her credit card and spends $700 buying her lavish gifts. She wasn't so pleased, and he was charged with 18 counts of stealing and false pretenses, for which he was fined $900 and placed on a three-year good behavior bond. Now, this woman soon becomes involved with someone else, and together they open a picture framing shop in Bondi. To get his revenge, he sets the shop on fire with a couple inside. Initially, Guider denied being involved, possibly due to the good behavior bond. But the following day, he turned himself into police.
In June of 1980, Guider was ordered to compensate for damages in the form of 7 monthly installments of $100 each. And these would be garnished from his pay. And his good behavior bond was extended for an additional 5 years. This would be Guider's first experience with criminal activity, but it would not be the last. Guider seemingly kept himself out of trouble. He worked as a groundskeeper and was seen as an amateur expert in Aboriginal culture and sites around Sydney. By early 1996, he was working with a woman named Denise Hoffman after a journalist introduced the pair because of their mutual love of Aboriginal history and art. On one particular day in March of that year, Guider and Denise were working together and planning another excursion to a site when the subject of Samantha Knight came up. And this was seemingly out of the blue, and it was Guider who initiated the conversation. He told Denise that he knew Samantha and her mother very well. This made Denise very uncomfortable, but she really thought nothing more of it at the time. That was until a couple of weeks later. And this was when Guider was arrested on suspicion of sexually assaulting 2 7-year-old girls. Court documents show he had been trusted to babysit the children by the mother of one of the girls. The prosecution would argue that the challenge of violating a child without it seeming too strange that a grown man was hanging around with young children was something that Guider got around by setting himself up as a neighborhood babysitter. The mother of one of the girls and Guider were friends. They had met 5 years earlier when the mother was a patient at the methadone clinic where Guider was working in maintenance. Now, on the day in question, he had taken the two girls to the beach for a swim. And during that outing, he assaulted the girls. He had taken photographs of them without their clothes on. And the next morning, they returned to the same spot and he assaulted them again. That night, one of the girls woke up in the middle of the night screaming out. She was in the middle of a nightmare. And this was when she told her mother what Guider had done to her. When the other girl was questioned separately, she mirrored the first girl's story.
This was what police needed to raid Guider's home and place of work. They found what would end up being thousands of pornographic images, all of children. All of them were taken with Guider's own camera, and a large percentage of them included images that were proof of serious criminal activity. They found a large box that had more photos, along with a number of books and pamphlets on sexual abuse, incest, and child photography. They found a bundle of notepaper that apparently listed on them names of children Guider had photographed. There was a brown suitcase containing a large number of photo negatives, a black Polaroid camera, and a mixture of children's underwear. They also found a series of paperback scrapbooks filled with newspaper clippings, and some were innocent. They were articles on archaeological sites and Aboriginal carvings, which we know was a hobby and an interest of his. Others were on just random subjects like sharks. Some were a little strange, like monsters and UFOs. But there were several on missing children's cases, with one entirely devoted to the disappearance of Samantha Knight. For some reason that wasn't really clear in any of the reading I did, the officers left without taking the scrapbooks with them. I don't know if it was a warrant issue or what. When Guider was interviewed by police, he admitted to assaulting the two girls at the beach and having an obsession with photographing children. Besides what happened at the beach, he denied acting improperly towards any of the children, except for the photos, which were definitely improper. He was even happy to give names of all of the children that he photographed. He also was questioned directly about Samantha, and he admitted to having known Samantha and that she was a pretty girl, and that he would visit Bondi regularly to look for her. He said he first met Samantha and Tess at a beach picnic in January, February of 1983. And then they met a second time at Samantha's friend Amy's house. Guider said he took photos on both occasions, but definitely not in a sexual way. When asked what he thought happened to Samantha, Guider added that he always thought Samantha was buried in Cooper Park, a bushland not far from Bondi. He said it would be an ideal location, and he knew about this because he'd been there before Samantha had even disappeared, looking for Aboriginal sites. But he denied any involvement in her abduction.
In the end, Guider was due to face sentencing on a massive 60 charges of sexual assault and indecency against 11 children. He didn't want to go to trial for this, so he offered to take the early guilty plea. He admitted to repeatedly assaulting a total of 9 girls and 2 boys over a 16-year period, dating back to when he was 17 years old. He had taken more than 3,000 illicit images and over 100 rolls of film that had yet to be developed. That blows me away. The prosecution argued that his sentence should have been the full 25-year limit due to the extensive amount of crimes he committed. But in the end, in 1996, Guider was sentenced to 16 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 10 years, which would mean he could have been free in 2006. The reason for the lesser sentence was explained away as because he'd taken the early guilty plea. He spared his victims the trauma of having to give evidence before a jury, and that was taken into consideration in sentencing. In September 1996, the newspaper got wind of Guider's questioning of Samantha, and it became front page news with a color picture of Guider holding a camera. Newspaper sales soared. The story would set off a new wave of public interest in the case, and more than 100 calls were received within days. It didn't take long for the revelation to flow into Goulburn Jail, where Guider was being held. Due to the way child molesters are treated in prison, Guider lies and tells fellow inmates that he was in for murder. But this all falls apart. Latest rounds of newspaper articles linking him to Samantha. One of the inmates, Bradley Roberts, who Guider had become friendly with, confronts him and he admits to his crimes. He said that he was charged with 60 child sex offenses. He had lured them with lollies and soft drinks that were laced with a drug he had a prescription for called Normicin, and that he had given Samantha some. He must have given her too much of it because she went to sleep and she never woke up. He said he had proof it was him in the form of photographs that he had hidden well at the factory in Sydney. He was more cryptic as to where Samantha was when Roberts asked him, and he said she was either at Cooper Park, the same park he mentioned in the interview with police, or in a mine shaft in a place like Lightning Ridge, a rural mining town. 3 nights later, Guider is bashed savagely in his cell. He received compound fractures to his right hand and leg and had multiple abrasions, bruises, and cuts, including one gash that required 16 stitches that had his left ear almost completely torn off. In all honesty, he was lucky to survive.
Because of Robert's report to police, the investigation intensifies against Guider. And the two friends that Samantha spent many a day with, this was Anissa and Amy, they were both questioned. It is revealed that Guider met Samantha more than twice and that he had been sexually abusing her for a period of 2 years. When questioned by police, Anissa told of Guider playing a series of games with all three girls. First, he would give them lollies or ice creams or soft drinks. Then he would tell the girls that if they told anyone about the treats, he would get into trouble and they wouldn't be able to have them anymore. At first, he would have them play a game he called Statues. And in this game, Guider would expose himself to the children, explain to them how their mommies and daddies had sex, and he would indecently touch them. And this is all while they stood like statues, and they weren't allowed to move for as long as they could. Anissa went on to say that Guider's favorite game would be some type of hide-and-seek game, where each of the girls hid in different rooms of the house. He would then set about finding them one by one, assaulting them as he went. Anissa then reports to police about one occasion in particular that really stood out to her. Something that unfortunately seemed to have occurred more than once to all three girls. One night, she was invited over for a sleepover at Amy's, but neither Amy nor Samantha was there. Amy's mother wasn't there, just Guider. Now, who exactly invited her over isn't clear in the research, and especially in the book Forever Nine by Denise Hoffman. And this is the same woman who worked with Guider that we talked about earlier. And it really is a thorough book on the case, and it goes more into Guider's criminal activity and his background than we can cover on this podcast. And Charlie and Allie will post links for the book on their website and their Facebook group. But in this night in particular, Guider was there alone with Anissa. He does his normal routine of giving her a soft drink, giving her candy, and all this was obviously laced with something because Anissa reports that she feels heavy and not entirely conscious throughout the assault. He takes her up to the main bedroom and sexually assaults her for up to 20 minutes. Now, this time frame is Anissa's estimate because she does admit to losing consciousness throughout the assault, and it could have actually been much longer than what she can remember.
Roberts wasn't the only prisoner that Guider confided in and claimed responsibility for Samantha's abduction. And by this stage, I think, unfortunately, it's widely accepted. She was murdered. In mid-1998, while in confinement, Guider told another prisoner by the name of Decker that all the times he had given the children he assaulted drug-laced food and drink, they were all fine, except once. There was one occasion where he picked up a girl, he had given her the drink and some tablets, and he had left her in a shed when a friend came to visit. When he came back 2 hours later, the girl was dead. Now, either he panicked or he and his friend both panicked, and they buried her in the park in an area where he was working. When police were searching for the girl, who he never actually names to this prisoner, he volunteers in this search. He says they never came close to looking where she was buried in those early searches, but 18 months later, they came close to finding her. But because of this, he went back and he removed her remains. He said that during the time he was working on a big gardening project and there was a lot of debris, he put her remains in a bin on the site and took it to the dump where everything was incinerated. Decker tried to encourage Guider to write the girl's parents, give them some type of closure. Of course, Guider refused. Then not long after this, he spoke to a third prisoner and gives him a third story. In this story, he picked up a girl that he refers to as Sam and says she had beautiful big eyes. He picked her up about a block from her house and gave her a soft drink and some candy to relax her. He took her to a cave where she died, but he didn't intend for her to die, but she did. He still took photos of her that he says no one will ever find. Then he hid the body somewhere the police wouldn't know to look and that she would just never be found. He hid these things so well that he will never be charged in her disappearance or her murder. They won't be able to find the evidence against him.
While police continued to build their case against Guider in relation to Samantha, they moved forward with the charges for the repeated assault against her friends, Anissa and Amy. And on February 11, 2000, Guider was sentenced to 6.5 years for crimes committed between January of 1983 and May of 1985. In his sentencing address, the judge describes the 17 offenses Guider was convicted of as appalling, and that he was a compulsive pedophile, and that it was recommended that Guider be given the hormonal drug Depo-Provera to control his impulses, which in other words, it's like a chemical castration of sorts. Unfortunately, Guider was only convicted for half the charges that were brought against him. And this was because Guider played the plea card, because he admitted to having committed the main counts of assault. The others weren't put on the table. They could be considered in calculating a sentence, but he wasn't actually convicted of them. They won't appear on his record despite there being significant evidence that he's actually guilty of them. Also in the plea deal, he wasn't questioned and didn't have to admit to giving the girls the medication Normosin to sedate them and his disgusting plan to assault them. This would have made the offense much more serious and hence attracted a harsher sentence, but they weren't included in his trial because of the plea deal. It wouldn't be until February 22nd of 2001 that the police were comfortable they had a convictable case against Guider to move forward with their charges. And the courtroom was packed when he appeared in the Sydney Central local court on charges with the murder of Samantha Knight more than 14 years after she disappeared. And it would take another 14 months on April 8, 2002 before the trial would start. The prosecution argued that Guider met Samantha when she was 5 and soon began babysitting her and her two friends for sleepovers and playdates. That the connection was there because he had previously admitted to taking inappropriate photos of her two friends. The prosecution also alleged the witness had seen Guider walking with Samantha near her home on the day she disappeared, and that she seemed comfortable with him. She didn't seem in distress or didn't resist and looked happy to be in his company.
In total, the prosecution will call a total of 38 witnesses to give evidence. One witness in particular gave quite damning evidence against Guider. Peter Bulgin worked with Guider for a cleaning company between 1980 and 1986. Guider had told him he knew the first aid center inside the bank branch they cleaned contained the drug ether. And he asked Bulgin if he would help him get some. When Bulgin asked why, Guider admitted to him what he was doing to the children he was babysitting, and he wanted to try ether instead of the Normosin that he had been using to see how that worked, whether or not it would be more effective. Bulgin refused to help. But later, Guider told him that he had managed to get some ether anyway. So in his testimony, Bulgin said that in conversations with Guider, he seemed obsessed with Samantha's disappearance because he told Bulgin he knew her and her mother. He showed Bulgin a photo of Samantha and her two friends at a birthday party that he had been at where they were all there. Bulgin also said there were a number of times he went to Guider's home and he had showed him photos of children in various states of undress. And Bulgin said that the children seemed to be out of it. And then the prosecution focused in on the jailhouse confession. So all three informants gave testimony of what Guider had told them, and one by one, they all testified that Guider told them he had given Samantha an overdose of Normosin in an effort to sedate her, to assault her, and then he disposed of her body. The defense argued that the death resulting in the use of Normosin was a highly unusual occurrence, and that incidents of the drug causing anything fatal was quite rare in anyone. That another drug would have had to have been used in combination, but this was not something Guider was known to do in his previous charges, and in turn, that would have been out of his character. Guider never takes the stand in his defense, which we all know that's not unusual in a crime like this. Generally, the defense is going to advise their client not to give testimony because it leaves them open to incriminate themselves. And in this case, where there was a lot going against Guider, it just wouldn't have made sense for him to say anything on the stand.
Privately, Guider had had several conversations with his brother, but he didn't say anything that was any semblance of guilt. However, in spite of maintaining his innocence up to this point and through the trial, Guider requested a plea deal. He wanted to change his plea from not guilty to not guilty for murder, but guilty for manslaughter. And just last week on the show, we talked about plea deals, and they're not common in Australia. And here, right after we say that, we have a case where the guy takes multiple plea deals. So this is an exceptional case in Australia, even though plea deals are quite common in the United States. The prosecution accepted this deal. We don't know exactly why the prosecution agreed, but we can assume that it was probably because of the lack of physical evidence. There was no evidence that Guider deliberately murdered Samantha. In his confessions to the inmates, he said he never intended to kill her. Without a body to show calculated murder, a manslaughter plea was probably realistically the best the prosecution was going to get. So on the morning of August 23rd, 2002, the judge handed down his determination. He handed down one of the longest manslaughter sentences in New South Wales history. Guider was sentenced to 17 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 12 years to be served concurrent with the time he was already serving. So basically, that means Guider would be eligible for release in 2014, which effectively added 8 years to the 10-year stretch he was already serving for the 77 child sex offenses he was previously convicted of that occurred between 1980 and 1996. Guider did apply for parole in June of 2014 when he had served his minimum sentence, which was 18 years and 3 months. This was rejected by the state parole authority. And there are several reasons given, including that he needed some sort of structured post-release plan in place so he didn't reoffend. Because due to his extensive criminal history, reoffense seemed highly likely. And I'm going to say 77 child sex offenses over 16 years, very highly likely he would reoffend. He also didn't show remorse or apologize for his crimes. His parole was again reviewed in April of this year being 2017. Again, it was denied. He can apply for parole again in April of 2018. And we'll keep you updated if and when Guider comes up for in front of the review board next year. There is a mechanism in Australia that they can use to keep him incarcerated, and it's called an emergency detention order. And the emergency detention order was created in 2014 to allow the government to more tightly supervise high-risk sex offenders like Guider and other violent offenders when the court believes they may reoffend after their release. This would give the government more time to get something in place that would protect society. They could then seek an interim detention order, which would keep Guider in prison and allow the courts to prepare and hear a continuing detention order. So, I mean, there are steps in this process, but the emergency detention order would just keep him in jail while they worked through this process. And this last order, which is the continuing detention order, it allows for an additional 5 years of incarceration. And then they could start the process over again if they felt he needed more supervision again. This is not a common process, and you can almost see why with all these steps. It has been in place for 3 years now, and New South Wales has used it once, and that was this year in a different case. Do you guys have any thoughts on the case in general?
I got some thoughts on him.
All right, well, let's hear them.
So, Charlie, you talked about people like Guider and the chance that they would reoffend. Walking through this case, doing the research that we did, that's my sense of this guy. I just, I don't know that for certain. I just don't see this guy all of a sudden being rehabilitated. I just feel like if he was to get out, there would be children in danger. That's my feeling on this case.
And I agree with that. I'm not comfortable, you know, having kids myself, little nieces, nephews, you know, when we were talking about these ages, you know, seven.
Man, they were young.
Young. Yeah, really young when he started to befriend them. And, you know, they're so innocent and they take to people so easily. And for someone to abuse that, manipulate that, it's just so wrong. You know, it just, there's nothing about that's okay.
I think there are multiple things in his case history that show that he's likely to reoffend. One is he was a continuous offender over a decade, that it wasn't as though he abused a child, had given in to that impulse, and then reeled himself back and then did it again. This was continuous. When the girls would be over at Amy's over the weekend, he would offer to babysit for these moms for free. And he would babysit them, and that gave him access. He worked very hard to gain access to the children, and he continuously was abusing multiple children over a 16-year period. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that he would reoffend the first chance he got. He is just not capable or willing to refrain.
Yeah, so I think we're all in agreement there. And had he not been caught, would he have stopped? That's kind of the question that I ask, and I say no.
No, he doesn't have any restraint.
Right, and he was caught shortly after the last child he abused. I think it's interesting when we talk about sentencing, and I always say, and I said it last week, I'm generally not a lock them up and throw away the key type. However, we have to have something in place for people like this who are at such high risk of reoffending that simply putting them on a registry isn't enough supervision. There needs to be something more to keep him from reoffending if he is ever allowed out. Whether he is allowed out and he is always in a halfway house, if he's constantly being monitored, but that takes resources from the state that I don't know that the state would be able to provide.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. You know, if you could say that some authority would be able to monitor him 24/7, that's great, but that's asking a lot. And you know as well as we do, Charlie, we've done a lot of cases that normally doesn't happen because of the reason that you just mentioned, resources. It is hard to watch anybody. You just can't watch somebody 24/7. You might have them check in on a weekly basis or maybe even more, but that's not enough.
And he was convicted on these 77 counts, but there were thousands of images that he had taken of children. Many of them he had drugged so that he could take those photos. This is a different level sex offender. Like, this is not, I don't want to say a generic sex offender because obviously there's no such thing as that. But this is someone who is calculating. He's willing to push the boundaries in order to fulfill his sexual desires. I don't think he would rein that in just because he got caught. And he's habitual. And his desire to keep pleading out, I don't think it had anything, even though they gave him credit for not putting the victims through the trial, that had nothing to do with it. He did it for himself. He did it to get a lighter sentence. I don't see it being wise for New South Wales to let him out. And I hope if he does get his probation or he eventually finishes his sentence, I hope they use this emergency detention order and hopefully they can save New South Wales kids 5 more years of not having to deal with this man.
Well, and you touched on it, and I keep going back to what was it we talked about? 3,000 illicit images and 100 rolls of film that were developed later. So, yeah, he was charged and convicted for 77, but you know that number is so much higher. It's scary to think how high it could actually be. But that was an interesting case. And, you know, we haven't done a lot of Australian cases, but we have done some outside the States, probably not near as many as you guys do. I'm always shocked by the sentencing, you know, especially Canada, Australia, and some other places. I'm not saying ours is better. I'm just, because of what we're used to, I'm always shocked with 77 offenses and this murder and 12 years. Now, he's gonna do longer, but when you hear 12 years, you know, you beat somebody up and steal their wallet, you might get 15.
Yeah, it's so different. And, you know, most Scandinavian countries, most countries don't even have a life without parole sentence. We're one of the only countries in the Western world that has a lock them up and throw away the key policy. And not even getting into the death penalty. So the U.S. is very different, but it used to not be. When we've done historic cases, we found that it's actually the 1990s tough on crime changed sentencing in the United States. And now you're much more likely to get a harsher sentence now than you were in the 70s or 80s. And a special thank you to Gibby and Mike for coming on our episode today. I want to give some shout outs. To our Patreon supporters, thank you so much for helping out. I want to thank Emma Z, Autumn H, Marissa S, Elizabeth G, and Sarah S. Thank you so much. And also to our five-star reviewers, The Thinking Brain, Luce's News, Arlo 3, California Girl 20, and Jesu is Kara. You can find us on Facebook at Insight Podcast. You can find us both in a group and on a page. We are on Instagram at Insight Pod. You will talk to Ellie there. I am on Twitter at Insightful Pod. You can email us insightfulpod@gmail.com. Visit our website, insightpod.com. Like I said, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/insightpod. There you can give a monthly donation. We have merch rewards. We also have occasionally early release episodes when we get them done early enough. And we have bonus episodes that go up every month on the 15th, usually the 15th. We're doing our best these days with the new baby schedule that I'm on. Thank you for listening. And again, thank you to Mike and Gibby. You can find them at True Crime All the Time and True Crime All the Time Unsolved. We will see everyone back next week.